ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do your grandparents give great advice? The kind of tips that really put life into perspective. Grandparents help shape our values and our sense of where we come from. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the bond between grandparents and grandchildren and why they matter more than ever. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The ceasefire between the US and Iran looks to have all but collapsed at this point.
Donald Trump has reinstated his naval blockade, and every day we're waking up to a slightly different plan for the Strait of Hormuz.
So how did we get back here?
And what is it going to take to resolve this conflict?
Today, is Trump caught in an escalation trap? I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Steve Kinnane. Let's go roaming.
Steve Kinnane, welcome to Global Roaming, a new voice on the program.
Ah, thank you, Latika. Great to be here.
So today's subject is, of course, none other than Iran. Impossible to miss the news this week. I mean, actually, it started last week when I was in Ankara in Turkey for NATO. Really did overshadow what was a pretty successful summit was this news that overnight, as Donald Trump was landing in Ankara, Iran and the United States were exchanging fire again over the Strait of Hormuz. And he was at great pains during his press conference after the NATO summit wrapped up to say, no, this is not full war. It's all going to be fine. It's all going to be end. We've got it under control. You know, the usual Donald Trump rhetoric that you hear. But as this weekend has transpired, Steve Kinnane, it's very clear that events are once more cascading in the Middle East.
Things are looking very bleak. Donald Trump is brought back a blockade. Our next guest is not very optimistic that the next few weeks are going to be very pretty. I'm really looking forward to hearing from Robert Pape on this because he has that historical perspective. And we know from the reporting of Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman what was going on in the Situation Room when President Netanyahu put forward this plan to Donald Trump, that they were very much listening to Netanyahu, that the US administration was not listening to intelligence officials, and it seems like they weren't listening to history. And that's what I really like about our next guest from his writings, Robert Pape. He's been studying the history of bombing campaigns, not just in Iran, but in other countries as well, and whether they work. And so I'm really looking forward to talking to Robert Pape.
Yes, an exciting guest for us on Global Roaming because Robert Pape is usually more accustomed to walking the corridors of power in the West Wing and giving his advice freely there. But today he's decided to join us from his position as a professor in the Department of Political Science at Chicago University here on Global Roaming. So, Steve, we're about to be treated to some of the insights he might, in any normal administration, be dispensing straight to the president or the Pentagon himself. Professor Robert Pape, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
So after several straight days now of back and forth between the US and Iran, is the ceasefire well and truly off?
Oh, yes, I would say so. And I think we are deep in the grip of an escalation trap. This has actually gripped us for quite a long time. There, of course, have been ebbs and flows, ups and downs. But the fact of the matter is, since the first bombs fell, this was always likely to end up at a place like this. I've been modeling the bombing of Iran for 20 years. I've taught for the U.S. Air Force for 30 years. I've studied every air campaign in history, economic blockades, economic sanctions, international terrorism, all of the different elements here that you would worry about in this war. And for in the modeling of the bombing of Iran for this long period of time, we've been going through the stages that I've identified, and I identified them even before the first bombs fell on February 28. I published a paper on this, and it's a trap. People find it hard to believe. You can't get out of a war Well, no one goes into a forever war thinking it's a forever war. It's really hard to get anybody to go into a war thinking anything other than it'll be quick and decisive. That's what Putin thought when he attacked into Kyiv. Donald Trump thought this was going to be a weekend problem, you recall. And then he said, well, another couple weeks. Then it was 6 weeks. And now it's, well, it's not so bad. It's not 10 years yet. So if you look at this, unfortunately, it's very understandable why the public is frustrated, doesn't want this war. Publics don't want any of these long wars. That's never the case. What you have here is the normal beginnings of what is actually a long war, and for some of the reasons I'm glad to explain, that routinely make what appear to be at first short wars, long wars, and why the combatants can't stop.
Robert, I read that piece you wrote in March in Foreign Affairs that you called Why Escalation Favors Iran, and it was subtitled Why America and Israel May Have Bitten Off More Than They Can Chew. So you called this early. Can you tell us why you came to that conclusion so early and what history told you about how a weaker combatant can undermine a stronger foe like the U.S.?
Basically, I identified that there would be stages of the bombing of Iran. The bombing of Iran really started with the bombing of Fordow, the U.S. bombing of Fordow in June 2025. And you'll see I have a piece in Foreign Affairs in June 2025 warning about what's coming. So the United States would be the only country that could bomb Fordow because it was so deeply buried, you needed the 30,000-pound bombs of the United States in order to attack Fordow. And so Fordow would be the critical decision point. If we bomb Fordow, our bombs would destroy the centrifuge facility, but not be able to get the enriched uranium, the 60% enriched uranium. And over time, we would start to fear the dispersal of that material because we wouldn't have on-site inspectors, no IAEA. They're not going to let Americans get in on the ground. And this is what I predicted to my class every year for 20 years, that it would be the bombing of Fordow, which would lead to the regime change bombing of Iran a year or two later. So then you have the bombing, the regime change bombing. Now you're going to get the stages of the escalation trap, which is the regime change bombing will occur, bombs will hit targets, bombs will kill leaders, and you might even then have bombs hit launch sites, but this will fail, the regime will survive, and they will lash back. And what are they going to lash back with? They're going to lash back and take Hormuz. And that is why then that's stage two of the escalation trap. Stage one is the regime change bombing. Stage two is they lash back. And then stage three then is what I call the dilemma. And that's where we've been for months, which is, do we go forward to take Hormuz back physically? Because we'll try punishment bombing, that'll fail. We'll try blockades, that's going to fail. So you're going to discover you're going to have to physically take Hormuz back. Or do you not take Hormuz back, capitulate, and Iran becomes the fourth center of world power? And now we're knocking on the door of stage three with the real dust up about to unfold quite likely here over the next couple of weeks in the Persian Gulf.
Robert, one anomaly to all of this is what happened in between the bombing of Fordow and the February 28 attack, and that's Venezuela. Do you think that the Trump administration changed the calculations about what might happen or the metrics of an escalation trap? Because they had a more recent modern history example of pulling off this great fantastical raid in Venezuela and thought that this might happen again.
Yeah, and so the answer is, I think it mattered a little bit, but not as overwhelmingly as it seems when people are only getting the tops of the events and so forth. With President Trump, it's important to remember that what he has been going to for years is Soleimani. He takes as his big, like, success with a leadership attack was the killing of the Iranian military leader whose name was Soleimani And this was not even in Iraq, but still, it was something that he pulled off, and Iraq did not lash back. So this happened in early January 2020, and what Iran did was they under-retaliated. They, in fact, gave a message to us hours before to get rid of, take the people out of the military base they were about to hit with 19 missiles. So they clearly were trying to say, look, we don't know what you're doing here. We don't want a big war with you. We got to lash back a little bit, but we're not going to do anything too bad here. And it's because we don't want to fight you, America. That's what they were really signaling at that point. Well, from Donald Trump's perspective, he read it a little differently or a lot differently. And you know this from all the speeches here, because he's constantly bragging that only he could do this because only he could do it and get away with it because Iran would never mess with Donald Trump. Well, that was not really the case. I mean, that's overreading Trump's personality by Trump himself. And the fact of the matter is, I think what happened here is Iran didn't want a big fight with the United States. They just didn't want it. They gave America a pass, a mulligan, essentially. And then we keep going at them. Well, at a certain point, all the gloves are off, and now it's the opposite. Now they're not backing down. They're not buckling. They're not going to break. They're going to go the other way. They're going to go the other way hard. And that's what you're seeing here. And this is what is fully tragic but predictable.
Robert, I want to bring you to the memorandum of understanding between Iran and the U.S., which has now failed. And I want to bring you to that and your theory of the escalation trap, how the rush to sign it, the language that was used, the players that were involved in negotiations, of course, J.D. Vance, but also Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Trump's golfing buddy, the real estate investor, Steve Witkoff, who has proved spectacularly naive in his negotiations with Vladimir Putin over trying to end the war in Ukraine. What was it about the memorandum of understanding, how that was signed, the language in it, and how that fits into your theory of the escalation trap?
So all of those factors, Steve, were there, and they are important, but of secondary importance. So the fundamental problem with the MOU was twofold right from the get-go. Number one, the MOU did not really fully resolve the disagreement among Trump, the U.S., Israel, and Iran about the new balance of power. The war didn't just have bombs hit targets, kill people, leaders, etc. The war changed the balance of power fundamentally and shockingly quickly. Before the war, America was the ascendant preeminent power. It was Israel that was the rising power, and Iran was a declining power. What happened in literally just the beginning of this war within a month is that those tables turned dramatically in all three places. America knocked down a rung. Israel suddenly much more contained, still fighting in Lebanon, to be sure. Don't want to dismiss that. But nonetheless, Israel getting pounded with those Iranian missiles here. Oh my goodness gracious. And then Iran grabbing and now clearly controlling Hormuz and the traffic through the strait. This was a new balance of power with Iran as the rising power. Within a year or so, could become the regional hegemon in the Gulf. So that MOU just simply didn't state that everybody agreed that Iran could be the next center of world power. For example, Iran thought it was going to be the next center of world power, but America wasn't really fully up for that, and neither was Israel. So that's why right from the get-go, this all started to fall apart. But there's a second big issue here, Steve, which is the oil inventory drawdown. And I've been warning about this since April. I've been saying the oil inventories are going to draw down. This would create Iran's period of maximum leverage. And what I said is this would create the incentives for Iran to initiate the use of force to get its way, to really get its way. Because remember, up until for much, and even still to this day, most people think if only you could put Trump in a box, this war would be over. Can't we just walk away? Can't we just abandon this? You know, get rid of Trump or get rid of this and it'll all come over. Well, that was true up until maybe April. But from that point on, we had killed about 137 leaders. That is like the president of the United States in America, the first lady in America, the first family in America, 137 members of Congress dead, the leaders of the Pentagon and the CIA all dead, and most of the cabinet dead, and 4,000 people in Iran, about 3,700. That's like a 9/11, except Iran is a third the size of America population-wise. That means we inflicted three 9/11s on Iran, three 9/11s. And so once you got into the later parts of April, when all this pain had happened, and then we threw the blockade in on top of that, and then Trump, of course, threatened to nuke all 92 million people on top of that. The idea that Iran would just sit back and say, oh, sure, that's all fine. We're all good now. It's not going to happen.
Professor Robert Pape, what are the options for de-escalation for both the United States and Iran? And from the United States' point of view, are there any options that don't involve capitulation?
Oh, well, yeah, so those days have long passed. So that ship has sailed a long time ago. So in my foreign affairs piece that Steve mentioned here, that was on March 9th. And there I'm recommending to President Trump right there in print to leave immediately. Declare victory. Say you had killed some leaders and stop. And that was a possible point where that could have worked. Then in April, I said, well, now militarily contain Israel. So there, I have more writings about this. The problem is that what happened here with President Trump is he followed this advice too late, months too late. And by then, all that damage I just laid out had already been done, you see. So this is why it's so difficult to unwind, because you have two engines of escalation. America wanting to reverse a defeat, and you have Iran wanting revenge. And both of these will interact with each other long before they'll wind down.
Can I throw in a little spanner in the works here? So there was a report on the weekend by Jennifer Jacobs of CBS, who's very well connected. Mm-hmm. And she reported, citing US officials, that errant factions in Iran had started attacking these ships, and that's what had triggered this last bout of conflict. Do we have any belief that perhaps the Iranians aren't seeking revenge? They just don't have control over who has control over missiles and drones in Iran.
Yeah, the problem with that, I understand. I follow those reports. They're just overwhelmed by the big facts, which is on Saturday morning, the Supreme Leader of Iran issued a big statement. He's only had seven, but he issued his seventh statement that is completely crystal clear, demanding the blood revenge for the deaths of the leaders and all the martyrs who have died. And by the way, he says in both wars, he means the June 2025 war as well. So he's tracking this here very closely the way the escalation model does. And also, you see the government of Iran, different spokesmen have reiterated that over and over here. So this isn't just a handful of errant people here. You've got tens of millions taken to the streets. You've got an overwhelming demonstration on the other side here. So look, nobody knows for sure exactly how tightly wired the inside of the government is. But at this point, it's overwhelming. All the other stuff just overwhelms those details. So I understand people are looking real hard on a microscope to find a way out of this. That's what's really happening. And it's very understandable because they're going to pay an awful lot of pain. And if those airlines start coming down, those airliners start coming down, that pain's going to go up, you see. So this is not a matter of we're going back to March. This is the potential, and it's not there yet, to be much worse than March. And so this is where we're really heading. And so when you ask, well, what can we do to get out of this? The problem is we've missed all of the off-ramps here. And we have our ships now within missile range of Iran. So Iran has not yet attacked one of our naval ships with those missiles, but they're using those missiles and drones. But I'm talking about the missiles now because those are bigger and heavier. The missiles to attack the ships today, this morning. So what Iran is doing is they're sending a clear message with those cruise missile anti-ship missiles they used on the UAE flag tanker. They're saying, look, America, look what we still got in our arsenal. And so far, those Navy ships are just marching right into the teeth of the missile network of Iran. This is really dangerous stuff, folks.
Finally, Robert, and briefly, what does this all mean for the Iranians who do not want to live under the tyranny of that regime? Those Iranians who bravely went out and protested on the streets.
Yeah. This is the most tragic element of all. So I have folks here who work the students at my summer. I have a summer research institute for Seapost, and I have some who have family there. And they asked me the question, and it's tragic. It breaks my heart. But they're 10 years away, minimum 5 years away from any good thing that's going to happen. And over the next 5 years, if you look at the outpouring of that nationalism and those red flags calling for revenge, anybody who doesn't support that is likely to get hurt or worse in Iran. So the idea that you can get away with the opposition, it's not just the secret police and the Iranian regime you have to worry about anymore. It's all those people with those red flags. And this is the world has changed, and this is why this war should never have been started. This war is not going to end just because everybody wants the war to end. That happened in all these other long wars we talked about, okay? This is not a happy thing I'm saying, but even if President Trump were to completely reverse course, I'm not hearing anywhere from the negotiators, the leaders of Qatar or Pakistan, anything to try to pull back Iran from its campaign of revenge. So this is really difficult. In fact, you have people from Iran on social media explaining why Iran is justified in killing President Trump, justified in killing the Americans as a result. So if you just go and look at those videos from some of those people, you will see they're on major podcasts talking about this. And what they're doing is they're saying it very nicely. But what they're saying is, Americans, you have to understand, this is just justice. You deserve it. And it's justice. So this is what social justice looks like from Iran's perspective. So this is not leading to everything's just okay. You see what I mean? We're heading to a really dicey period of time. And I think some of the most dangerous weeks of the war are coming ahead of us. I hope I'm wrong. And I hope we find a way, but we have to now pull back both sides. This is why this war should never have been started. The real mistake was bombing Fordo. And this is just everything that's happening has been predictable almost to the month since. And I know that sounds hard to hear because the public doesn't follow this stuff. They're not supposed to follow this stuff.
Robert, thanks so much for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
That was Professor Robert Pape from the Department of Political Science at Chicago University, and you can read his Substack, The Escalation Trap. Well, Steve, a fairly dire warning there from Robert Pape. Worst days are potentially ahead of us. So, I mean, the shocks to the global system, the economy, not to mention, of course, just the sheer violence in the region. If that comes true, and we have no reason to doubt that it won't, given all of his prophesizing has come true, as he so clearly said out there in that interview, we're in for a wild ride.
Sure are. He said that the next few weeks could be the worst. He talked about that drawdown of the oil that has continued to happen despite there being a ceasefire. That is going to have massive implications on the global economy, but also in domestic politics in the US with President Trump and with the midterms coming up. But also what he had to say, I thought, about how bleak it is for those brave Iranians who do not want to live under this regime, who've gone onto the streets who've been mown down on the streets for protesting, and the families of those people and people who want democracy. He was saying there, I think, 5 to 10 years before you could even see potential progress in that area.
Yes, you know, I'm not completely convinced by his theory of total revenge in Iran. I do think when you have bombed and taken out that much of the leadership, that much of the core organs or brains that were operating before, I do think it's highly possible, per those reports that I put to him, that there are errant factions. And in fact, if you go back to some global roaming episodes we did earlier in this year, we did talk about and canvass this exact possibility that actually now you have renegade factions or people who aren't taking orders or taking it into their own hands with very quick and easy access to low-cost technology such as drones that can really cause a lot of havoc, and not just for the United States, but of course its partners in the region and across the Gulf. And I do think we're starting to see that materialize. Now, obviously I'm not an expert, but that was one point where I did just wonder if maybe there might be some more cracks of grey than he's letting on.
Yeah, but I mean, you talk to other Iranian experts and they say this has been going on for nearly 50 years and it is so much a part of the state structure with the Revolutionary Guard, that it is a very difficult thing to imagine that this regime would crumble. And I think the thing that everyone has always said, that if it was to crumble, it would have to come from within. And it's not going to come from bombing for regime change.
You know, when you asked that question at the end, Steve, I was reminded of the very first day of this campaign, and it's a theme and subject we've forgotten all about, tragically, which is, remember, Trump himself came out and said, this is your one time to rise up and take control of your country and we can have a happier Iran. And I mean, that fell away from the United States language and even goals about what they were doing in Iran very, very quickly. But I do think, and I'm reminded of it when you asked your question, how tragic it is that that is now one of the last things we think about when we discuss this war, if not an afterthought.
Absolutely. And I remember speaking to members of the Iranian diaspora at the time, and there was almost a sense of optimism amongst some of them that something may come of this. But yeah, they've very been forgotten in this equation. So much of it is we talk about the world economy, but what about the people there? What about the people who've been living under this oppression and want a different life?
Well, Steve, it's been great to have you on Global Roaming. Perhaps our listeners have some feedback for you. Please keep it coming, including your questions and ideas for future programs too. We read them all. Our email is, of course, global.roaming@abc.net.au.
And a big thanks to the Global Roaming team, producer Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe.
And Steve, if you've got 30 minutes spare, tune in. Tomorrow's episode is, I think, pretty unmissable. It's a great interview that Laura Tingle and I have recorded about France's Marine Le Pen and why she might be the most viable populist far-right leader to sweep a Western European country next year. It's a really great episode, so I hope you tune in, Steve.
I look forward to it. See you later, Latiga.
See you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.